And good morning and welcome to this May 17th, 2000 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org and we are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. One of those big treat days for me as we're going back into the world of the short story. I love the short story. I'm excited this morning to welcome Elizabeth Strout back onto the show. She will be here with her novel In Stories. I actually pre-recorded our interview last week. I'm going to play it now. And in the second half, the great Andrew Rowe will be here with his latest collection, Where You Live. So I'm going to get Elizabeth Strout started. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the interview. Elizabeth Strout is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Olive Kittredge, the number one New York Times bestseller, My Name is Lucy Barton, The Burgess Boys, Abide With Me, and Amy and Isabel. She's been a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award and the Orange Prize in England. Her short stories have been published in a number of magazines, including The New Yorker and O, the Oprah magazine. She's been on the show at least twice before, most recently with me last year with Lucy Barton, and back in 2009 with Barbara, talking about Olive Kittredge. You can find copies of those interviews up and available on our website. Her latest is Anything is Possible. It's published by Random House, and it's the subject of our chat today. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thank you so much.
I love having you on. It's funny. So the book was sitting on my nightstand, and my husband saw it, and he said, "Oh, you know, anything is possible." And he said, "Do you believe that?" And I said, "Yeah, and you know, in this political environment, anything's possible." Sort of struck me as like one of those Rorschach tests of, are you a positive person or a negative person? Like, how do you take that?
Exactly. That title has been so, yeah, you're exactly right. It's funny. Yeah.
So tell me about your, you know, oftentimes if you, I don't know if you're describing this as a novel or as a collection of linked stories, but often the title of the book comes from the title of one of the pieces, and that's not the case here. So can you talk a little bit about that and titling the book and what was on your mind when these came about?
Right. Well, I started to write these stories really at the same time that I was writing My Name is Lucy Barton. And I would sort of move over to a different part of the table that I work at as I listened to the mother and daughter talking about, you know, Mississippi Mary or the Pretty Nicely Girls. And I would think, oh, you know, what happened to them? And I would start to write about them. And so I really wrote the book much of the book in tandem with My Name is Lucy Barton.
It's so funny because when I was reading Lucy Barton last year, I was thinking, God, it'd be great to read about all these other characters because what a, you know.
Oh, good. Well, there we are.
And then it worked. Yeah, and then it worked.
So there you are, yes. So, and Anything is Possible comes from the very last line of the book when Abel Blaine is in the ambulance. So that's and I thought, okay, that sounds like a title for this book. So anyway, there we are.
Yeah, perfect. So talk a little bit about that process of writing this alongside writing a novel and, you know, keeping the novel thread in your head while jumping back and forth to write these short stories. That's great.
Right. It was an odd experience, the whole thing. It felt very organic, and it felt like it was coming out naturally in a way. There was no real pushing it around too much, and so I would just write different scenes. That's how I work. I do write in scenes, and then I had to concentrate on My Name is Lucy Barton ultimately, you know, to pull that together as a novel. But then I looked and I saw, oh, I have real nuggets here of another book. And so, and then a couple of the stories I added later, like Sister, the one where Lucy actually comes back to visit. I wasn't sure that I wanted Lucy to show up in the book herself, and so I had to think about that a lot. And I tried it different ways, and then I realized, well, you know, if I sort of sidled up next to Pete Barton, her brother, then maybe we can do this. So I did. That was, I think, the last story that I wrote.
So interesting. It's harken back to the structure of Olive Kittredge and, you know, I don't know in which form you kind of feel comfortable, but you just fly, I feel like, in the short story form. It's so, it feels so natural for you. Mm-hmm. So did the novel, but
right,
really
right, right.
really feels like a natural form for you.
Yeah, and the way they're connected, it's like I don't really care if people think of them as short stories or a novel. It doesn't make any difference to me. But I do think of them all as one piece. So as I'm writing them, I don't feel like I'm writing separate stories. I'm writing a whole, it's like a whole piece of cloth is spread out on the table and I'm sort of moving around from parts to parts, you know?
Yeah, right. Talk a little bit about your connection to Illinois. All of Kittredge took place in the Northeast, and I really liked this being set in Illinois. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, when I first began My Name is Lucy Barton, I was just sort of playing around with different scenes of this mother and daughter in a hospital in New York City. And then I realized, okay, I just saw Sky. And I realized, oh, Lucy Barton is going to come from Sky. And I pictured this little tiny house with just lots and lots of sky around it in the way that you can't get in New England. I mean, obviously there's sky in New England, but you know what I mean. There's just so much sky in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And I'd been to the Midwest a number of times, and I found that sort of freeing and interesting. And I realized, okay, so we'll put Lucy Barton there. And then my husband and I made a number of trips out there as I was writing Anything Is Possible to make sure that I got all the details right. You know, I wanted to make sure I had just the right kind of soybean growth at the right time of year. And we also went at Thanksgiving time. We had a Thanksgiving in a congregational church, just like Lucy Barton went when she was a kid. So, you know, that was fun and interesting. So I feel that I have a real appreciation for that part of the country.
I feel like it would give you more empathy now for what our country is going through and the divisions that
we
feel. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, there's an awful lot of people out there in varying degrees of distress.
Yeah. We all need a little bit more empathy these days. And even reading this gives you, I think, more empathy for some of these characters.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, I mean, you've always been, interested throughout all of your books in issues of class. And the thing that struck me in this, the interesting part of that, is when people crawl out of their class, like Lucy crawled out of her class.
Yes, exactly.
There's a clawing back, right, of people not
appreciating. Yeah, well, I mean, there's always, it's a very American story, you know, to leave one's class. And to climb or to even go further down, I suppose. But that is an American story. And the sense of Lucy Barton herself, excuse me, having, you know, crossed class lines to become arguably an upper middle class woman, I just kept thinking, what does this feel like for her? And that, you know, that inclination to, as particularly as she gets older, to need to go back and visit and try to visit.
Yeah.
There was that.
Yeah, I was also really struck by kind of the recurring theme of women leaving and what a stigma there is about the women who walk out the door and, as opposed to the men who walk out the door and the women who choose to stay and the women who choose to go.
Right, and that came from My Name is Lucy Barton because the mother had stayed in the marriage. Her mother, Lucy Barton's mother, stayed in that marriage, which was obviously difficult for her. And so she told stories without even realizing it. She was kind of congratulating herself as she told these stories about women who had left and, you know, how they came to a bad end. Kathy Nicely came to a bad end. And so those were the stories that I was picking up on from Lucy Barton's mother telling these stories about the women in that time and place in history, of the, you know, when Lucy was a young girl. Yeah. That she and her mother were talking about back in the day, you know, when she was little. In that time, in that place in history, then it was difficult for women to leave. And they did come up against things. And so that was interesting to me, and that's where those characters came from.
Still, I think that still happens, that you don't give women a break for leaving.
I think you're probably right. Yeah. I do. I think you're probably right. Yeah, yeah.
And even the women who stayed to raise their kids and then left later in life, they didn't really get off the hook. You know?
I know. Poor Mississippi Mary. She was just looking for a little love.
Right.
You know. Anyway, she found it, but at cost.
At cost,
because, you know.
Yeah.
Right. At cost, yeah.
Ain't that life.
Yes, exactly.
My guest this morning is Elizabeth Strout. The book is Anything is Possible. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. One thing that I've done lately with short story writers, because I'm just mad for the short story form, I always have been, is to take one of these. It can be any one of these that you think that may have given you the most trouble. Maybe it's Sisters that you mentioned earlier giving you pause, but any one of them, and kind of dissecting it from the original kernel of conception to maybe how it changed and what problems it may have given you.
Right. You know, Mississippi Mary seemed to give me the most problems. And I just rewrote that story a number of times. And I finally realized that one of the problems, dramatically speaking, you've got two very likable characters. I think, you know, I think both of them, they're very well-meaning, as opposed to somebody like Charlie McCauley, who's very distressed because of his war experience. And in a way, that's almost easier to write because you've got the distress and then you've got his family and, you know, his woman there and stuff like that. But with Mississippi Mary, I finally realized, wait a minute, I've got two characters that are both very decent, good people, and where is the tension going to be coming from? You know, so I had to keep going back and forth to get the tension that the daughter is really feeling about the situation, and to pull that up,
right?
And to try and get that to work. So that was a tussle for me, that story.
Did you get to go to Italy so that you little research?
I have been to Italy, actually. Yes, I have been. I spent a month in Bogliasco at the Bogliasco Foundation, and so that's why I chose that town, because I know it.
So great. One of the things that I think you're so wonderful at, and that I think is really difficult, especially for the short story form, is managing backstory and getting and making sure that, because there's a lot of historical weight in all of these, of what these characters have been through and you know, relationship history.
Exactly.
But you don't want the backstory to overshadow the regular, you know, main thrust of the story. And I don't know if you have any insights that you can share on kind of how you manage that.
Well, I think it's important for me to know as much as I can know about the people that I'm writing about. And then it's almost like the tip of the iceberg. You only want the tip of the iceberg to be available for the reader, because that's really all they need. And so there's a lot of editing that I do. There's a lot of scratching away, and then I hopefully, you know, give the reader enough. And I also want to leave space for the reader to enter that story that I'm writing. And so the more I tell about the people, the less space is going to be available to the reader. That's how I see it. Mm. So I need, you know, because every reader has their own life experiences, and they'll bring those life experiences to the reading of the book. And they should. And that's what I want to make sure, that they have enough space in the story to enter it with their own experiences as well.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. And when you know that you've struck that balance, I guess it's kind of a matter of time and experience, maybe.
It is. There's a lot of experience. Right. You know, I was thinking about that just today. It just floated through my head. I thought, well, I've been at this a long time. You know, and so there is a sense now, more than when I was starting out, of how to manage that, how to get that, to do that.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that I marveled at in these is your your restrained scenes of violence. There are such cringeworthy kind of violent acts between these characters, but it's never over-the-top obvious violence. It's like calling somebody a piece of filth, or, you know, cutting up somebody's clothes in a closet, or, you know, just these... You don't need a lot of dead bodies laying in the street, right?
And No. And I'm not a person who... I don't feel that it's necessary to really press the reader's nose into anything, you know, gratuitously. I guess that would be the word. You know, I just need to say enough that the reader can understand what happened, but I don't need to press their face in it, you know?
And I think that's a great lesson for writers to be. The more restrained, the bigger the impact, I think.
I think so. I do. Yeah.
Yeah. There were twin stories in here that probably aren't twin stories in your mind, but they just struck me as resonant with each other. One is Dottie's Bed and Breakfast, and the other, the name of which I now forget, but it's essentially a couple that lends out their guest room to a woman in town. And I was thinking of the...
The very interesting
thing of opening your home
cracked.
To...
That's
cracked. Yes, cracked. Yeah. Right.
Yep.
Oh, God, I love that story. opening your home to strangers, and then kind of, you know, you don't know these people, but now you're all sharing a roof and the...
That's right.
Kind of violent intimacies.
That's very interesting. I didn't think of those as twin stories, but you're absolutely right. They're like flip sides of the same coin. I mean, you know, one's an inversion of the other almost.
Right.
You know, because Dottie is obviously, not Linda Nicely.
Right, right.
Or her husband, you know. Yeah. But yes, you're absolutely right. You know, what is that like to open one's home and to have, various things going on inside that home?
Right.
And, you're right.
Do all of these just bubble up from your subconscious and you discover it after the fact that, oh, that's what I was trying to get at, or that's what was on my mind?
You know, it's so true that my subconscious or unconscious or whatever it is that's not conscious is really so much at work for me. It still amazes me how much my unconscious or the subconscious is at work while I'm working. And then later, as I look at it and I realize, oh, okay, this or this or this, I'm just always surprised that the subconscious is working so hard for me.
Thank God.
Right? Yeah, I guess. But I honestly feel like very little of what I do is conscious. I mean, I'm perfectly aware that I'm writing. I'm not saying that I go into like a fugue state or anything. I know exactly, you know, that I'm sitting there and I'm writing, but then later I look and I realize, oh, that's so interesting. I was really actually doing that or that or that without fully understanding that at the time.
Right, right. Yeah, one of the examples of that might be, as I was reading this, I always, you know, if I'm going to interview the author, I just make little notes in the margins of, and one note that I made throughout this was the word shame, and I wrote it like, you know, 8 dozen times. And then I read an interview you just gave that said, I didn't even think about shame when I was writing it. And I'm like,
you're exactly right.
So funny.
You're exactly right. It is so funny. And I thought about that since that interview, and I realized, of course, there's so much shame in there. That's essential to those stories. And I didn't see that as I was writing it. I was just writing them and they are about shame.
So,
But there's a lot of shame that we carry around in various forms, I think.
Well, it's such a primal human emotion. I mean, it's there from almost, you know, the time you're 2 years old, right?
That's right. That's right. We're always feeling that we're not doing something right or something. Some variation of shame is usually with us, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And inherited shame. There was a lot of inherited shame here from, you know, even if the character wasn't responsible for it, it was handed down. And
that's right. That's exactly right. And that does interest me. I mean, on a conscious level, that does interest me in terms of families handing down shame and how people, you know, cope with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. My guest this morning is Elizabeth Strout. The book is Anything is Possible, and you are tuned in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. It was a big cast of characters, and I even found myself, you know, trying to take notes about who is this person and how they're related to this person. And it's always such a pleasure to read one story and realize, oh, this character from this story just walked in the door. And I, you know,
isn't that fun?
It is fun. I was wondering, for you, how you keep all of these people straight. And, you know, if you have a big map in your dining room or something to keep
it. No, that's all in my head. It's funny because I'm a very messy worker. Like the table has tons of pieces of paper over it all the time. But in my head, I seem to have some sense like, oh yes, okay, now we're going to have Charlie McCauley reappear here in the bed and breakfast, and we're going to find out that, you know, his pain did come to him, and then we're going to see him later with Mississippi Mary, just mentioned, you know. So I have a sense as I'm working where they will show up again, and I don't know how I keep them all straight, but they're just there in my head.
That's fantastic. I need. We all. We all need Elizabeth Stroud's brain.
Oh God, no, you don't. But thank you.
Yeah, it's interesting. What I had heard some George Saunders advice about rendering a character, and he said, you know, I always ask them, tell me something about yourself that would make me love you better. And when I was reading this, I thought, you know, a lot of these characters could be reduced to stereotypes or reduced to something, and they never are. They're mm-hmm. so full, and they're so rich, and they're so, mm-hmm. by the end of it, you know, mm-hmm. we feel such empathy for these people. And I was wondering if you have techniques like that where you ask of characters, tell me something, you know, whisper in my ear and tell me something else about
right.
yourself.
You know, one of the things I think that may be relevant to what you're asking is that when I write, and I realized this years ago, when I write, I suspend judgment of my characters completely. And it's so freeing because we do judge in this world, you know, that we live in. We walk around and we do judge other people rather consistently. And it's so tiresome. But when I go to the page, I suspend all judgment on my characters. I don't care what they do. They can behave very badly or not. But and so there's this sense of transcendence that I think I have when I'm working with them. And so perhaps that's what you feel. You know, I just want to be reporting on them, telling the reader, this is who they are. This is what we're all up to here on Earth. You know, this is the human experience as far as I can share it. And so the judgment of my characters is never, you know, it's not there. And that's, like I said, it's very freeing for me.
Yeah. I had heard something you said somewhere, because I stalk you periodically, about, you know, one of your earliest realizations as a kid was that you only got to, I'm going to butcher this, but you kind of only
right,
got to see the world through one set of eyes, and what a tragedy
that's
that
right.
is.
Oh, yes, and I've never gotten over that. I can remember when I realized that, and you know, I was young, and I realized I will never know what it feels like to be another person. And I have absolutely never gotten over that. And I'm constantly, constantly wondering what it does feel like to be another person. And I think that fiction is one of the few ways that we can get a glimpse of it. Because when I first read fiction when I was very young, I can remember thinking, oh, I had that thought. I didn't know anybody else had that thought, you know, that kind of thing. And so hopefully when somebody reads my fiction or any fiction, that they will have a sense of like, oh, that's what it would feel like to be that person. And so two things can happen. They can become more empathic, hopefully, as a result of that. And they can also learn something about themselves that maybe they had forgotten they knew about themselves.
Yeah, right. As you look over the course, now that you've been writing many novels and short stories over time, do you see your areas of interest shifting? Are certain things becoming more important to you than they used to be? Or do you look across your body of work and say, I've always been interested in that theme?
That's an interesting question. I think that I have always been interested in just the ordinary lives of ordinary people, which would be most of us, really, you know, but just the simplicity, what would appear to be a simple life is what interests me, because it's not. Nobody has a simple life, you know, and so that's what is constantly interesting to me, is let's just take Patty Nicely out there in the Midwest, and she's a guidance counselor, and let's look at her and what she's gone through, and you know, what her first husband had gone through and all that sort of stuff. And it's just interesting to me to think that anybody we pass on the street has layers and layers and layers of an inner life as well as an outer life that, you know, we won't know about. So I make it up.
Yeah. I remember one writer gave the advice that the next time you're in the grocery store and the guy is bagging your groceries, just think he always wanted to be an opera singer. And, you know, give him the courtesy of always having wanted to do that.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Or, you know, a cab driver or anybody. I mean, these are all people who have deep wells of feeling somewhere, I think. And that should be respected.
Yeah. I think that is perhaps key to, I mean, I've been asking writers a lot now, how do you sustain your energy given kind of the swirl of the world around us? And you know, yeah. Is art important, or should we be putting all of our time towards, you know, resisting what's going
right,
on?
Right.
What, you know, what's the purpose of it all?
Right.
But I think these acts of empathy might be the answer.
You know, it's funny because I did sort of recently, of course, wonder, what am I doing? What's the point of writing stories when there's so much stuff happening in the world? And then I just told myself, well, that's what I do. I'm a storyteller. And I've always believed, even, you know, at a much younger age, that a good story can help somebody.
Yeah.
And so if the right person reads it at the right time, they can perhaps, you know, see something that they haven't seen before. And that's my contribution to the world. So, you know, and I think actually more than ever, the arts are important.
True. True.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, and your
even
characters even though it's discouraging.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, it's easy to think that they're not right now with everything that's happening, you know, but I think actually, in fact, they remain very, very important.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just going to say that your characters are so relatable, and so every woman, every man.
Yeah, I hope so.
That it's, you feel less alone in the world, I think, when you read, you know, these women who are aging, or they're losing their sexuality, or whatever they're going through, and you're like, that's how I feel, or that's, you know, there's something connective in there, and I think we're now striving to be more connected in some ways. So.
Right, exactly. And that's what I'm hoping for as a writer, is to, you know, have it be received by a reader who can feel those things as a result of reading it.
Right. We're drawing down on our time, but I wonder if you have any, beyond all we've talked about, any advice for writers of the short story form or the novel form that you've gleaned across all these books you've written?
Yeah, this is what I would say to people who want to be a writer or who are writers and struggling, you know, to be published, is just, first of all, don't stop. If you really want this, you just don't stop. But also read good sentences. I think that if you can read good sentences, I've gone back to the classics all my life just because they're wonderful sentences, and I think that your writing will be, as you know, related to the level of the reading that you're taking in. So I would say don't read bad sentences, because it's like eating bad food. Mm-hmm. And so keep reading and keep writing. Just keep doing that and you will get better.
I love it. And it's so true. I'm amazed at the number of writers who, you know, you say, what are you reading? They're like, I don't have time to read. I'm like, but that's what you need to be doing.
But that's what you have to do.
Yeah, I know.
One of the fun things about being a writer is that every time I'm reading, I think, well, I'm not wasting my time. I'm doing what this is my job.
Right.
Yeah.
Me too.
Really, very helpful.
This is actually my job.
That's right. Isn't that wonderful?
Isn't that great?
Right.
Elizabeth Strout, this is always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
This was great.
Lovely to talk to you always. Thank you.
Thank you. Always, always love talking to Elizabeth Strout. That was Elizabeth Strout. Her book, Anything is Possible, is out and available now. It's really wonderful. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Andrew Rill will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes under College Radio, or you can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. Lots and lots of information up there, lots and lots of interviews. I don't know if you know, but we are celebrating 20 years on the air next year, next April. So on that website are all of those interviews, hundreds and hundreds of interviews, as well as information on upcoming shows, who's coming up, speaker series events, and more. Speaking of the speaker series, we had a great one last night, and Andrew Rowe, who's on with me now, was a guest there. So if you were there last night, extra special treat. You get to hear a little bit more of Andy right now. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Andrew Rowe is the author of The Miracle Girl, which was a Los Angeles Times Book Award finalist. He was on the show with me in 2015 for that. Again, you can find that interview up there. His fiction has been published in Tin House, One Story, The Sun, Glimmer Train, Slice, The Cincinnati Review, many publications, as well as anthologies in 24 Bar Blues and Where Love is Found. His nonfiction has been published in the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Salon, and elsewhere. He's back with an awesome collection of short stories, a few of which were published in some of those places I just mentioned. It's called Where You Live. It's published by Engine Books, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Andy, welcome back.
Well, thanks, Marie. Thanks so much for having me back, and it was great to see you last night. Had a great time there.
Wasn't that fun? I know.
Yeah, I love
those events. I love those events. Everybody who listens to the show knows I'm wild for the short story form.
So when
I saw both one of my favorite writers was now writing short stories, I knew you were writing short stories, but now that it's out in a collection, got super excited. So excited that I tried to have you on months ago and you're like, you know, the book's not even out yet, so calm down.
Well, I appreciated the enthusiasm, so thank you. Thank you very much.
So take us inside this collection. I know that some of these stories have been written, you know, over a long period of time. I think the collection was gathering momentum for a long time. And just talk about kind of what was on your mind, what themes brought this into a collection.
Yeah, there was a couple of things, and as you said, it's kind of a collection that spans a lot of time in my writing path, which has been a bit of a long and winding road. But as far as the themes around the stories, as I was writing them and publishing them, I talked a little bit about this last night. There were just certain stories that seemed to share similar preoccupations and themes, and one of them was definitely place. There is a geographical connection with the stories. Most of them take place in California and in different parts of California, so it really runs a wide gamut of the state, anywhere from San Diego, where I live, and Los Angeles and Whittier, where I'm from, to the San Francisco and the Bay Area, where I've lived for many years, and I'm actually in the process of moving back there, and even up to further north to Humboldt County, where my wife and I lived for a couple of years. But I think it's one of the things that interests me in some of these settings is kind of depicting a California that you don't typically see depicted in books or movies or TV shows, and this was a little bit of a similar preoccupation with my novel as well, to kind of show more of a working class, more characters who are struggling to make ends meet and treading water and kind of living with decisions that often don't turn out to be the best type of decisions. And then as far as you know, the other connections thematically, there are a lot of character, a lot of relationships. So there's a lot of relationships between spouses, between parents and children, a number of characters who are making that transition from young adulthood into parenthood, and not unpredictably, sometimes these things don't go well as life gets more complicated. I would say that there are these characters who have kind of a simmering sort of low-grade unease with themselves and their life choices, and they're really kind of trying to find themselves and their place in the world. And there's a chronicling again of marriages and navigating the complexities of these relationships and how we handle disappointment. I guess that sounds a little bleak, but you know, there are some jokes in there here and there, and I hope there's some resilience that we see in some of the characters as you progress through the book. And the last word of the last story of the book is in fact the word hope, and that was certainly done purposefully.
Indeed. Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because as you're describing them, I'm like, yeah, that sounds familiar, but I didn't get the impression reading it that it was depressing. You know, it wasn't depressing to read.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, no. So jumping back to this issue of setting and place and all of these places that you've lived, I was wondering, I always think it's interesting to talk to writers about writing a place where they are versus writing a place where they have been, and whether that perspective of distance is easier on you if you see a place differently after you've left it and more objectively, or if it's harder to access.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's interesting when, in terms of my novel, I mean, I never really thought I would write too much about Southern California and where I grew up, and that was actually one of the reasons fueling my move to San Francisco, as I felt like I needed somewhere more, I guess, literary or something, you know, silly like that. But when it came time to write that novel, the majority of which was written in San Francisco and Humboldt County and also down in San Diego, I think it did help to have a distance there. And so I hadn't lived in Whittier since I graduated from high school, so I'd been gone for quite a long time. So for me, with that novel, I think it was particularly helpful to have some distance from that. In the case of the stories, it does kind of vary. I think some were written, I know the story that appeared in one story, it's called America's Finest City, and it takes place in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and I was living there while I was writing that story. And I think you could also make the argument that it's also fresh, it's where you're living, it's very vivid, but that's an example of a story that started from, I had a friend who had a cleaning business, and I would clean houses and also clean a Starbucks in San Francisco, and I was working late at night and just on this kind of alternate universe where you're working at night and everybody else is asleep, or a lot of people are asleep, and that was kind of spurred that story, just riding the bus in San Francisco and experiencing that kind of Twilight Zone existence. But yeah, sometimes I do think in general, though, that having some sort of distance is helpful. But again, it just really depends on, you know, where your head is at when you're working on a story or a book.
Yeah. I really appreciate this observation about writing a California that you don't see in movies, because California is astronomically expensive. And I think the majority of the residents are, it is a struggle. And you see the perceptions on TV, or you drive through Laguna or Newport Beach and you think it's all rich people. It's just not.
Yeah.
Just not, so that's great.
Yeah, it's really varied, and there's so much to California. Even just, you know, the experience of living in Humboldt County, a lot of people think that California ends in San Francisco, and there's a whole other 5-6 hours of drive to get to to get to Oregon. So it was really eye opening to live there as well. And even just recently, maybe last year, my wife and I were in, driving through Los Angeles, and I can't remember which area it was, but it was a very sort of urban, bleak area, and she was just commenting on, you know, and not having been to certain parts of Los Angeles before, so this is tough. This is not, you know, the la-la land that you typically see in movies and such.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm curious about this writing these stories over a long period of time. Two things kind of strike me about that. The first is how your writing changes over time. You know, if you wrote a story 10 or 15 years ago, keeping the writing quality consistent, was there a lot of revision at the end to bring the quality of stories that you'd written years ago up?
Yeah, there was some. I guess I was a little surprised going back and looking at some of the earlier stories. It's funny because I was kind of dreading that, and sometimes I was pleasantly surprised where it didn't need too much work, or I felt pretty okay about a story, but then surprisingly, the newer stories were the ones where I was kind of more gnashing my teeth about. So I'm not sure what to make of that. But yeah, it is a challenge to kind of keep that consistent tone and what you're trying to create on the page when you're writing these stories over a prolonged period of time. But as I think I talked a little bit about last night, I mean, I was publishing other stories, and I have other stories that didn't get put in the collection. So as I started just to compile this group of stories that I thought would, you know, have a dialogue with each other and would work well in conjunction with a larger book, they already kind of had some of that similarity. So when the time came to really look at the collection as a whole, it felt like I'd been working on these stories fairly regularly over the course of years, so it didn't require too much. There was one story that just seemed like tonally that wasn't right that I did want to include, but I thank my editor, Victoria Barrett of Engine Books, which has been a great experience working with her, that just was a little off. But for the most part, it was just a little bit of honing and then finding all those writerly tics that, you know, you realize you use the same word over and over, or the same phrase, or the same character names. So it was mostly kind of more mechanical stuff like that when it kind of got to the final edit.
Right, right. And do you find over time that kind of the things that are interesting to you, that the characters that are interesting to you and their problems remain fairly consistent? There's a lot of pregnancy and maybe yes. ambivalence about pregnancy in here.
Yes.
I think everybody who's gone through getting pregnant or on either side of the gender role feels a little bit of ambivalence about it. But do you find that over the however many years this collection was coming together, that some of those themes just continue to endure for you, or do you feel your area of concern kind of shifting over time?
I think because I had a specific world that I was imagining these characters, that they stayed quite similar. And what was also interesting is that, I think I mentioned this again last night too, is that as I was going through the stories, I noted some of those similarities that I hadn't been forefront in my mind. Like you mentioned, that there are several pregnancies, some more prominent in the stories than others. And so as I was going through that, I said, I think there's something here. This is a recurring thing. And then there was also just some, you know, handling of elderly parents and of course the setting. So they all kind of happened, I would say, at least seemingly in the composition of the stories, fairly naturally. And I just, again, had this kind of world and these characters envisioned, and that didn't change too much, I guess. And maybe that's partly due to the fact that I was working on other stories and also working on my novel while these stories were being written as well.
So great. I heard some, I think it was Robert McKee once said, you know, if the story you're writing is the story you're writing, then you're in deep, you know, crap, that it's not going well for you. And I don't know if you had that experience. It sounds like you did have that experience, that you look back on your work after it's done and you say, oh, that's what that was about, or that's what I was interested in. And what a good sign that is, that what you think you're writing about is something else. And
yeah. Yeah, and to me, I think that's one of the wonderful surprises about writing. I mean, I'm sure that there are writers who are smarter and better than I that might have be very clear about what they're trying to say and what they're exploring, and maybe that element of surprise doesn't creep in. Although I tend to think that it probably does, but for me personally, I have those realizations of, yes, oh, that's something that I'm interested in. And it might be subconsciously in the back of my mind, or readers or friends will point out things, and that will surprise me as well. And then maybe that's something that I wasn't even on my radar in terms of what I was trying to do on the page, but somebody read it, interpreted it as such. And I always hesitate to say that, nope, I didn't have that in mind. I just kind of, oh yeah, sure. That was I meant to do that. I'll take credit for the multiple interpretations. But no, it to me, the surprise of the day-to-day work of where a paragraph or a sentence takes you is really one of the joys, in addition to those larger surprises too.
Oh, for sure. And I think that translates to the reader as well, that if the writer is not surprised, I think it's very hard to pull off the reader also being surprised, or, you know,
yeah.
I mean, the subconscious is just smarter than the...
Yeah, yeah. Certainly in my case.
I think in everybody's case. And there's so many wonderful plays with, you know, there are stories that are kind of one or two sentences, like, you know, 100 words, and there are longer traditional stories. And I was wondering if you gave yourself challenges, or if you gave yourself prompts, or if you wrote to flash fiction contests or something, because there's such a wonderful experiment with the form of the short story in here.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if it was all organic, or if you kind of set yourself little challenges.
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. I mean, I was at a point where I was writing a lot of flash fiction. I've been writing more traditional length short stories for a while, but probably around 2006, 2007, I got interested in shorter pieces. There were just a lot of really interesting short fiction being published online, and so I did start writing it. And this was also a time where I have a twins, a boy and a girl, and an older son, and so my writing time was very limited. And so I really liked, I don't know if I thought of it as a challenge, but I definitely had smaller chunks of time to devote to my writing, and I just thought that flash fiction was a good fit for that. Although I think some people have the belief that it's easier to write flash, and I would propose that it might be even harder, because you have these short pieces and they really sort of carry the density of poetry almost, if you're really, you know, getting down to that word sentence level, and so sometimes those can take quite a while to compose. But then I started thinking more about the form, kind of as you said, and well, what constitutes a short story. I don't do prompts very often. There is the very first story in the collection is a very, very short piece called Close, and it's a single sentence. And I did have that idea or sort of challenge of I wanted to write a single sentence story. And of course it was written on its own, and then as I was putting together the collection, it just felt like it provided a good entry path into some of the themes that the book was going to explore. So that was kind of a challenge to myself, of like writing a one sentence story. And some are a paragraph, like long paragraphs, some are two or three pages, some are five or six pages, some are more traditional short story length, 15 to 20 pages. And I think the one of the challenges in putting that together was not to make it seem very jagged and uneven. And again, I credit my editor, Victoria, who did a great job of helping me arrange the stories. And I think we achieved a nice sort of balance and rhythm between the shorter pieces and the longer pieces. And I've gotten some nice feedback from readers so far about how they feel that rhythm really, really worked and shines through in the book.
It really does. Yeah, it really works well. My guest this morning is Andy Rowe. The book is Where You Live. It's published by Engine Books. But before we get into that, so the Miracle Girl came out from Algonquin, right?
Yes.
And this came out from Engine. Did you find the experience of publishing a collection of short stories? I know it's always a little bit more difficult to get short story collections out there.
Yeah.
And switching publishing houses, was that a little arduous, or did it happen fairly naturally?
Well, I did take the collection to Algonquin, and as you said, short stories are definitely a tougher sell, and they decided to pass on that, and so there was no animosity there. I wasn't necessarily surprised on that. So at that point in time, we had the collection, and I had the novel came out, and it didn't exactly set the world on fire, but still, hopefully, it kind of generated some notoriety and kind of helped pave the way for this next book. And so what my agent and I did when Algonquin passed was to put together a list of smaller publishers that we thought would be a good fit, that we respected, and so we included Engine Books on this list. They've published some great stuff. Robin Black, who's a writer I greatly admire, they published one of her a craft collection, and they're also publishing some out of print books. And so yeah, it's a smaller publisher this time around, so it doesn't necessarily have the kind of support that a larger publisher like Algonquin has, but we're doing our best to get the word out. And I'm just as you said, Marie, short stories are tough to get out there. So I'm just been super happy that this is happening as a book. It's been something that I was hoping would happen at some point in time, and I'm just very grateful and happy that it has happened.
Yeah, I do feel like short stories are enjoying a bit of a renaissance over the past couple of years, and getting the credit that I strongly believe they deserve.
I know, and I always love how passionate you are about short stories, and when you get to talk to folks who have collections out, so it's really great to hear your enthusiasm.
Yeah, well, one of the paces that I've been putting short story writers through lately, and I just put Elizabeth Strout through in the last half hour, is to take a story from the collection and, whichever one you think makes the most sense, maybe the one that gave you the most difficulty or the one that changed the most over time from its original kernel, and kind of take us through it and what the original kernel of the idea was, how you struggled through it, how it emerged, and how it surprised you. I hate to put you on the spot like that, but it's kind of fun.
That's a great question. I hope I can keep par with Elizabeth. Let's see. I think maybe a good story to talk about would be, it's one that's called Not the L.A. in My Mind. It's one of the longer ones in the story. And the reason that one comes to mind is that I finished writing it last summer, so it's kind of one of the latter stories in terms of composition, but that's finish it. That's not not writing it. So it's a story that really the kernel goes back even to high school or post-high school. I had a friend who graduated from high school and decided not to go to college. I was telling this story to my wife the other night. I don't think I'd ever told it to her before, but she went to work as a phlebotomist, and I remember she told me, my friend phlebotomist, I didn't know what that was, and she said, well, I draw blood from people, and she was making at the time, I don't know, $18 or $20. This was back in 1985, and I thought, well, that's making pretty good money right out of high school. So the idea of a story about a phlebotomist was something that stuck with me. And then many years later, as I was thinking about how that could become a story, I had the first line of the story came to me, and the line was, I know blood. And I had that for a long time, probably a couple years, and I had written a little bit more just talking about this person who was somewhat distant and removed from life, and had this very sort of intimate job of drawing blood from people, but again was very removed and isolated, and I just thought that was an interesting juxtaposition. And then probably maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I had some other ideas about the story and like having another character kind of enter into this main character's life to somehow kind of wake her up and shake her up. And I was thinking it might be a romantic thing, but I kind of wanted to keep it a little more not as certain as that. And so finally, I was on vacation with my family last summer, and we were traveling through, actually going up to Humboldt and along the Oregon coast. And for whatever reason, maybe being away from my routine, I just had a burst of ideas for the story of how to kind of make it work structurally. And so I was just, when the kids would go to bed, we'd be staying in Crater Lake, and I would just be turning on the flashlight and jotting down notes for this story that I wanted to finish when I got home. And so when I got home from the trip, I went ahead and finished it and did another couple drafts, and then the story was finally finished. So there's a story where, again, if you go back to the very first pangs or explorations, it goes back to high school. So I guess the point there, hopefully, is just, patience. Sometimes stories happen in a much quicker, more efficient way. Sometimes they just need the right time to elapse before they're ready to be written.
Boy, that's true. Yeah, that's really true. One quick question before we're drawing down on our time, but
sure.
God, I have so many questions. About endings and knowing when the ending is the right ending. And, I think a lot of short story writers tend to write past the ending. And I think short stories often end on kind of an unsettling, unknown note that's resonant, but not, pretty bow kind of note.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you had any comments on that.
Yeah, endings are really, really tricky, and then sometimes they do go on too long. I guess I really try to strive for, ideally, in an ending, is that I just kind of, the idea of just you're kind of, as you're reading that final sentence or two, it's just kind of like holding your breath, and it could be something very strong and powerful, but it also just could be something internal. One thing that we talked a little bit about last night too is I got some great advice from Hannah Tinty at One Story on the one story where instead of the story going on too long, she was thinking that the story needed to breathe a little bit more and needed to wind down a bit more before we got to the end. And so that was kind of a little bit of the inverse of what you typically hear, but I took her advice and revised the ending of that story, which is also in the collection. And so sometimes it's okay to linger a little longer if that's serving the story.
She's such a brilliant editor, I think.
Oh, she is.
She's fantastic.
Yeah, and a great writer as well. So, yeah.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. Any last minute words of advice for short story writers or novel writers?
There's a couple things that have been banging around in my head. One thing, it was somebody else's advice. Neil Gaiman, I think, I saw something he came across online. Like, finish things was the was the advice, and I definitely need to heed that advice. I'm kind of working on multiple projects right now, so I think that's pretty good advice. The other thing that I've been thinking about lately, and I just published an article on Writer's Digest website that talks a little bit about this, is that, you know, there's no one right way. I think to be a writer and to write, I think for a long time I wasted a lot of time banging my head against the wall thinking I was doing it wrong. And you'd hear stories from authors about writing a first draft and dumping it in the trash can and then starting fresh and starting anew, or you had to get an MFA, or you had to do this. And so what I've learned is that really everybody has to find their own path. And so you can listen to all the advice in the world, but then ultimately you have to kind of filter it out and find out what works best for you. Those are a couple of things that I've been thinking about recently.
Yeah, that really came out of the salon last night, listening to both you and David Francis was there and talking about your different approaches and other people's different approaches. And, you know, you're right. I mean, you just, you have to find out what works for you. And that takes time. And I think that's where writers can get discouraged and say, I'm going to throw in the towel. Pushing through that resistance and making yourself find, you know, your own strategy, I think is one of the lessons out of this. So that's great. Andy Rowe, I always love having you on.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Marie. Went fast.
So fast, always. It always goes too fast. I know. This was a huge pleasure. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much, Marie. I really appreciate it.
Too. That was Andy Rowe. The book is Where You Live. It's out and available now. That's unfortunately all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.